The field of my investigation is the Ottonian period, that is to say, from 936 to 1024. And my lecture today will focus on the role of eschatology, conceptions of time, and the understanding of the course of history in the Ottonian culture. The aim is to explore how it was possible to cope with the future in the Ottonian period. To this end, I have investigated a number of documentary, liturgical, and narrative sources that had been produced between the middle of the 10th and the first quarter of the 11th centuries. This slide displays the list of these sources, relating each of them to its specific context of production, that is, the Kingdom of Italy, the North Alpine Kingdom, later known as the German Kingdom, and the Duchy of Lotharingia. These three European regions were encompassed at that time into the Ottoman Empire. My lecture is divided into three sections. The first section focuses on eschatology, since in every medieval Christian society, eschatology provides a fundamental knowledge to cope with the future. Particularly in the case of the Ottonian period, speaking of eschatology implies being involved into the highly controversial issue of apocalyptic expectations at the turn of the millennium. As we shall see, many hints suggest to exclude the hypothesis of widespread apocalyptic expectations at that time. The second session explores the perception of time and history emerging from Ottonian sources. Here, I shall explain what I mean by transcendence and by contingency. Moreover, I will show how both the traditional linear and cyclical conception of history cannot be found in the Ottonian sources, since their narrative patterns suggest a different perception of historical development. Therefore, both the first and the second section provide a description of mentality of the authors of Ottonian sources, that is, their world views by which the uncertainty of the future could be understood in that period. Instead, the third and the last section seeks to verify whether these worldviews were only opinion of the well-educated clerics and monks, or whether they showed any connection with the dynamics of political institutional life. Therefore, I shall consider some distinguishing features of the Ottonian kingdoms with a specific focus on the lack of Herrschaftsrationalität, that is, the lack of political rationality in a Weberian sense. Our investigation into eschatology and eschatological beliefs in the Ottonian period begins with one of the most prominent authors of the time, Bishop Dietmar of Merseburg. With reference to the rejection of Christian faith by the Slavic tribe of Abrodites in 1018, Dietmar wrote in his chronicle, and I quote, "Let no faithful heart despair because of this misfortune." The misfortune is the apostasy of the Abrodites. "Or believe that the day of judgment is fast approaching, since, according to St. Paul's truthful admonition, one should not speak of such things prior to the discord," in the Latin text dissensio, "and cursed arrival of the Antichrist. Let this be a warning for us, that we may always be careful and vigilant, since we have no certainty regarding the future, and our very weakness denies us any permanence. Moreover, one should neither doubt the coming of the last day, nor hope that is close by, since it is fearful even for the righteous and much worse for anyone worthy of punishment. End of quote. These statements clearly follow the sharp condemnation of speculations about the end of the world made by St. Augustine. Augustine indeed taught that the end was unpredictable to all but God, and that its imminence could be neither inferred from worldly events nor associated with specific calendar dates. This Augustinian teaching had been accepted by the Venerable Bede and then disseminated in the sources of the early and high Middle Ages. In order to better understand our quotation from Tietmar, we need to consider that he wrote in 1018, exactly the same year when the event referred to occurred, I mean the apostasy of the Abrodites. Accordingly, Tietmar's rejection of apocalyptical speculations meant that he categorically excluded that his present was the apocalyptic time. It is possible that someone in his diocese could have been fearful, even because Merseburg was close to the region of the Abrodites, but in any case, Tietmar utterly excluded that the Antichrist was close and forbade even discussing about this issue. Another important source of the Ottonian period is the chronicle The Deeds of the Saxons, written by Widukind of Corvey in the last period of the reign of Otto I. Widukind wrote that at his time, and I quote, the monks began to suffer severe persecution because some bishops claimed that they thought it better for a few men to live distinguished lives, rather than for many half-hearted men to dwell in the monasteries. They forgot, unless I am mistaken, the views of the head of the household, who prohibited the servants from gathering the weeds, noting that it was necessary to allow both weeds and wheat to grow until the harvest. In the Latin text, et zizania et triticum usque admessem, according to the Gospel of St. Matthew. Therefore, Widukind refused the idea that only the chosen few were entitled to embrace the highest way of life, according to the German idiom weniger ist mehr. He stated that both good and bad people, symbolized by weeds and wheat, will coexist for the entire course of history. They will be separated from each other only on the last day of the world, and not before. Here we find another teaching of St. Augustine. According to Augustine, the earthly world does not coincide either with the city of God or with the city of man, but it is a civitas per mixta, a mixed body, where the two mentioned cities remain overlapped until the last judgment. Therefore, Widukind clearly denied that the end was imminent at this time. Now we move on the Sibylline tradition. According to the surviving manuscript tradition, the prophecy, surviving manuscript evidence, the prophecy of the Sibyl Tiburtina should not be included in our investigation. In fact, the earliest surviving Latin manuscript is dated 1047, that is to say, during the Salian Age, and therefore after the time of the Ottonians. However, recent studies assume that the text of the Sibyl Tiburtina was assembled in its entirety for the first time in the Latin West exactly in the Ottonian period. Another hypothesis, which I think is much more likely, is that only some interpolations were added during the Ottonian period into a pre-existing patchwork. This patchwork was a very fluid text, interpolated many times by a number of authors and in response to a variety of situation and purpose, over a long period of time, at least from the 8th century onward. Whatever the correct interpretation is, it seems that the Ottonian interpolators handled a text whose general structure was quite similar to the one we know today on the basis of the manuscript evidence and tradition. This structure has three sections. The first one is the late antiquity core of the prophecy, dated in the second half of the 4th century. It deals with the dream of nine sons that 100 Roman senators simultaneously had during the same night. According to the interpretation of the Sibyl, the dream symbolized the unfolding of history along nine ages, from the creation to the end. The second section is an enigmatic list of kings, enumerated in chronological order from the 4th century up to the last emperor, without including him. Lastly, the third section contains the prophecy of the last emperor, who will come at the end of history, just before the Antichrist. In the light of this structure, it is notable that the Ottonian interpolators affected only the second section, the enigmatic list of kings, while neglecting the sections that could be interpreted or manipulated apocalyptically. The first one with its theology of history, and the third one with the prophecy of the last emperor. This means that the Ottonian interpolators did not modify the pre-existing text to spread apocalyptical anxiety. They simply added some positive comments about Otto the First and Otto the Second, and a very hostile comment about Otto the Third, as we can see in this slide. They did not identify any of the Ottonians as the last emperor, and the very hostile comment on Otto the Third did not comply at all with the messianic and highly positive idea of the last emperor, who would establish the kingdom of God. So it seems that whoever interpolated the text during the Ottonian period did not perceive his time as being the apocalyptic one. Turning our attention now to the most well-known eschatological text of the Ottonian period, we can consider the letter on the origin and time of the Antichrist composed by Abbot Hazel of Montreal. This letter was written in the middle of the 10th century at the request of Queen Gerberta of West Francia, daughter of Otto I. We don't have to be misled by the title. In fact, Hazel aimed to show that the Antichrist was not imminent and that his advent should not have been a reason of concern to the immediate present. Hazel wrote, and I quote, "Therefore, the Apostle Paul says that the Antichrist will not come into the world unless the discessio," in the Latin text, "comes first, that is, unless first all the kingdoms which long ago were subject to the Roman Empire secede from it. This time, however, is not yet come. As long as the kings of the Franks who possess the Roman Empire by right survive, the dignity of the Roman Empire will not perish altogether, because it will endure in the kings of the Franks." End of quote. Therefore, we can easily understand that the main content of the letter was not the end of war, but the enduring stability of the kingdom. After all, the concept of stabilitas regni, or stabilitas imperii, was one of the most important ideas of political thought in the early and high Middle Ages. The Augustinian orthodoxy of the letter of Hazel can also be reinforced by the fact that the following generation often attributed this text to Augustine himself. Even though this short lecture cannot offer a comprehensive overview of eschatological references in Deuteronomian sources, I must add that some few sources mention forerunners or accomplices of the Antichrist, referring to some people acting in figura antichristi or as membra antichristi. However, we never find any mention of the Antichrist himself. I believe that we cannot ignore that these two different identifications, to be a forerunner of the Antichrist or to be the Antichrist himself, are not the same. For example, the Annals of Quedlinburg, in their entry of year 997, defined John Philagatos as membrum of the Antichrist. In that year, in fact, John Philagatos plotted against Otto III and was elected as antipope. Evidently, this was a harsh sentence on John Philagatos made by the Annals, but not an identification with the Antichrist. This interpretation is confirmed by the following part of this annalistic source. The Annals cover history until 1025. Between the above-mentioned entry of year 997 and the last entry of year 1025, the Annals did not give any information about Antichrist and his partners. Such an absence would not have been possible if the author had believed that the apocalyptic times had already begun in 997. What I have tried to show so far is that the authors of the Deuteronomian sources that I have analyzed did not believe that the end times were at hand. But to avoid misunderstandings on this point, we need to make a distinction between apocalypticism or millennialism on the one hand, and eschatology on the other. Only expecting the end with anxiety and excitement, only calculating the end and dreaming of an utopian paradise on earth, was strongly banned by the Christian doctrine, and in Ottonian sources these feelings are nearly absent. By contrast, there was nothing unorthodox about believing to live during the last age of the world. The last age of the world began much earlier than the Ottonian period, according to the authoritative periodizations of the fathers of the Church, which were well known in the early and high Middle Ages. I refer to the theology of history of the four empires and to that of the six world ages. In fact, according to Saint Jerome and Paulus Orosius, the rise of the Roman Empire marked the beginning of the fourth and last empire. And according to Augustine of Hippo, the incarnation of Jesus Christ marked the beginning of the sixth and final age of the world. Such a distinction between apocalyptic or millenarian anxiety, which was banned, and a eschatological awareness, which was instead admitted and even fostered, could explain, for example, a particular passage of a royal charter issued by Otto I for the monastery of San Pietro in Celdoro in Pavia. The charter asserted that Otto I was established by God, I quote, "in the last age of the world," end of quote. But such an awareness did not prevent the Saxon emperor being concerned about the behavior of his successors, as shown by the clause that committed the future kings to respect this privilege, as we can see in the slide. Therefore, in the charter, the eschatological awareness to live in the last stage of the world was not translated into the belief that the apocalypse was imminent. Otherwise, it would have been really unaccountable to express such a harshly anti-Augustinian and unorthodox belief exactly in the charter, in this charter, issued, as I said, for San Pietro in Celdoro in Pavia, that is, the monastery that stored the relics of St. Augustine, the main censor of any apocalyptical excitement. To summarize, we can say that the Ottonian authors believed that they were living in the last stage of the world, and that the end might come at any point, according to the unknown plan of God. However, this consciousness did not trigger widespread apocalyptic excitement. Rather, this eschatological consciousness fostered individual concern of the Last Judgment. This was surely useful to cope with a specific kind of future. I mean, future after individual death and or after the end of the world. Anyway, the future placed beyond historical time, that is, eternity. But what about coping with the near future, the one before the end? What could the future bring according to the Ottonian sources, the near future? In order to try to answer to this question, we need to consider the world views of Ottonian authors with reference not only to the future, but also to past, present, and more generally, life on this earth. Many authors of the Ottonian sources show a vivid perception of the contingency and uncertainty of history. Not by accident, one of the best sellers of the Ottonian period was The Consolation of Philosophy. In this work, Boethius used the metaphor of the wheel of fortune to reflect the unpredictable reversal fortune that everyone could experience in his own life and that Boethius himself experienced very deeply. The wheel of fortune was mentioned by important Ottonian authors, in particular by Liutprand of Cremona and Gerbert of Aurillac. In the letters of Gerbert of Aurillac, the wheel of fortune is mentioned to display that the course of history was simply, I quote, fluitantia, fluctuation. To Gerbert, this meant that earthly events seemed to be only, I quote again, fallacia et inconstantia, fallacy and inconsistency. Among the Ottonian authors, Gerbert was certainly the one that brought the role of fortune to the limit. In some confidential letters, it is even difficult to understand whether Gerbert believed that the blind fortune, as he wrote, blind fortune, was under God's control or it had its own strength. It is worth quoting, "The blind fortune rolls the world, and it puzzled me in the fog. So I don't know if it makes me fall or leads me, since it brings me here and there." End of quote. However, these sentences remained rather isolated. All the other Ottonian sources that I have analyzed did not admit any possibility of a divorce between fate and providence, that is to say, between contingency and Christian faith. Some instructive examples are provided by Liutprand of Cremona. The striking rise to power of Romanus Lecapenus, a man of humble origin who became Byzantine emperor in 919, led Liutprand to think about contingency, which he called mutability. In his view, a continuous mutability affects biographical events, historical facts, and more generally, earthly realities. Liutprand wrote that the wheel of fortune predominates over men so that homo exterior, is he called the man who is still in the state of sin, is not able to handle it, to handle the contingency. Only Homo Interior, as Liutprand pointed to the spiritual man who is reborn internally and lives in a state of grace, can cope with contingency. Furthermore, Liutprand did not interpret the case of Romanus Lecapenus only by the metaphor of the wheel of fortune, but first and foremost by quoting the Old Testament. He wrote, and I quote, "The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings you low and lifts you up. He raises up the poor out of the dust and lifts up the beggar from the dunghill to set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's." End of quote. We see here how biblical wisdom allowed to understand contingency and to cope with it. Such wisdom refers to a continuous alternation between exaltatio, to be lifted up, and humiliatio, to be brought down, according to the teaching of the Psalms, the book of Job, and the book of Kings. This alternation happens because God allows it, in order to stretch every man so that every man could show whether he trusts in God or rather in human beings and worldly goods. This idea is also conveyed in the title itself of this work of Liutprand, Antapodosis, which can be translated as Book of Retribution. In fact, Liutprand seeked to show that evil men often prevail in history, but their success is doomed to last only for a short time until the appropriate retribution, the antapodosis, comes. Then God rewards with humiliation the proud who was lifted up for a while, and with salvation the humble who were brought down. In Liutprand and in all Ottonian sources analyzed, contingency was understood as the instrument of divine pedagogy. This means that such a perception of contingency always complies with transcendence, that is, always complies with faith in God as providence. As the fluctuation between exaltatio and humiliatio sheds light on how divine pedagogy works in individual life, the same dynamic can also be seen in political life. With a little variation of terms, the Ottonian sources speak about a continuous alternation between pax and discordia, peace and discord. Such an alternation is the main historical dynamic that can be drawn from the patterns of Ottonian sources, in particular from the patterns of Ottonian narrative sources. I could provide several examples from Widukind, from the two hagiographies called Life of Matilde, from annalistic sources such as the Annals of Quedlinburg and the piece written by Adalbert of Magdeburg. Moreover, this dynamic can be glimpsed in the Ottonian poems too. For instance, the deeds of Otto I written by Roswitha of Gandersheim explained that only short-term period of peace followed each success of Otto I, so that the king had periodically to deal with new conflicts. In the poems of Leo Vercelli, the physical presence of the Ottonian emperor ensured peace and stability, but a cosmic disruption inevitably occurred every time the ruler died. In particular, however, I would like to point to the chronicle of Dietmar of Merseburg, whose narrative pattern is clearly shaped by a never-ending fluctuation between pax and discordia. As we can see in the slide, in the yellow line, Dietmar highlighted enduring peace under Henry I, continuous alternation between pax and discordia under Otto I, Discordia under Otto II, peace under Henry II, even though Discordia periodically broke the harmony of the kingdom. The same dynamic, but with a different periodization, can be seen in Thitmar's judgments of kings. Black line slide. Thitmar thought Charlemagne was the best ruler ever. After him, there was not any great ruler for one century. Then, Henry I ruled as a good king, but his successor, Otto I, was much better. In fact, Thitmar wrote that Otto I had restored the golden age on Earth, but unfortunately, only for some years. So came Otto II, and a dark period started. Thitmar's contemporary king, Henry II, restored a new glistening age. Also, the history of the Church of Merseburg was described according to a similar dynamic, red line in the slide. Thitmar pointed out how this church flourished under Henry I, was destroyed by Otto II, and then flourished again under Henry II. We could say that Ottonian sources ignored both the linear and cyclical models of historical development. Rather, historical development follows a movement that can be described as sinusoidal, even though in a highly irregular way. According to such a sinusoidal movement, the actual attainment of good political order, the high peak of the sinusoid, was always considered possible, but was doomed to last only for a short period of time. The same can be seen at the lowest points of the sinusoid. Moreover, such a way of thinking was not contradicted by prophetic texts. We have already mentioned the Sibyl Tiburtina. As we said, the first part of the prophecy, the Nine Sons' Dream, was read and known in the Ottonian period, even though it was created many centuries before. According to the general opinion of the scholars, this prophecy would prefigure a steadily and linear decline of mankind, but this text did not predict any linear decadence. Rather, it highlights a sinusoidal historical development. It is worth quoting. The first sun was splendid, shining over the earth. Therefore, this first sun is yellow. The second sun was more splendid and great. In the Latin text, splendidior, more splendid, having ethereal brightness. The color is brighter than yellow, confirming that this sun is better than the first one. The third sun, blazing with the color of blood, was fiery and terrible, and in the end, rather splendid. The first red sun symbolized decline. The fourth sun was ruddy, and there were four beams of light radiating from it midday. So we have another red sun. The fifth sun was dark, bloody, and flashing as if in dark thunder. Here we glimpse a further decline from red sun to a dark red sun. The sixth sun was very dark and had a barb like the sting of a scorpion. Here the decline is absolutely evident. We have a sun that is completely black. The seventh sun was terrible and bloody, having a foul sword in the middle. This black sun symbolized After the black sun, a dark red sun symbolized progress, not a further decline. The eighth sun was spread out, having a bloody color in the middle. The sun is clearly less terrifying than the previous two. And the ninth sun was very dark, having only one shining ray. Again, here, we have a dark sun, but the shining ray makes it better than the sixth sun, which was completely dark, as we said, and had a sting of a scorpion. This is important because the ninth age was perceived by Ottonian readers and interpolators as being their present and future. In short, the course of history embedded in this prophecy is more complex and less linear than a constantly progressive decline. Consequently, it would have been difficult to foresee whether the next events of the ninth age would have been better or worse than those occurred in the past. We could ask ourselves now whether such a way of thinking was only rooted in the minds of the educated authors of Ottonian sources, or whether it mirrored the dynamics of political and institutional life. I do not think that this mentality was pulled out of the air. Several clues suggesting that political contingency deeply affected the Ottonian way of ruling. In 956, Caliph of Cordoba, Abd al-Rahman III, strongly criticized Otto I. In his opinion, the Saxon emperor had totally relinquished the control of his kingdom. In actual fact, at that time, Ludolf, the son of Otto, plotted against his father in conjunction with several magnates. To the caliph, the problem was that Otto I shared his power with aristocracies and neglected to optimize the exercise of power through suitable administrative tools. This external observer, the caliph, pointed out a fundamental aspect of the Ottonian government, the lack of Herrschaftsrationalität, that is, the lack of political rationality in a Weberian sense. This means the lack of regularly planning the political action in order to tame the future and reduce contingency. Furthermore, the Ottonian kings did not even have the means of control that such rationality would have demanded. For example, their administrative structures were very weak if compared not only to those much stronger of the so-called modern state, this is obvious, but also if compared to the previous Carolingian comital districts and to the later Salian network of ministerials. Also, a synchronical comparison between the Ottonian kingdoms and some contemporary political bodies outside of Latin Christianity confirms this picture. In the 10th century, the Byzantine Empire, the Abbasid Caliphate of Baghdad, and the Umayyad Caliphate of Cordoba were tightly structured institutional systems, which could somehow rely on bureaucracy, administration, and state organization. By contrast, Ottonian political rationality consisted in handling specific matters from time to time without a predetermined design. The primary role of the Ottonian itinerant kings was to incorporate and integrate several actors into the same political body and not to impose strict control over them. Power, deeply unequal in its distribution, rested in reciprocity. Also in settling conflicts, the leading idea was not to inflict the judicial punishment on the offender, but to negotiate a judicial compensation that could give satisfaction to the injured part that in case of conspiracy was the king himself. This is also the reason for which the primary royal virtue was the mercy, clemencia, and not yet the harshment of the law, rigor justitiae. After all, since the king could not control and prevent aristocratic conflicts, he could realistically only attempt to negotiate peace after the rise of a conflict. Royal mercy was the means to achieve this end. This way of settling conflicts could work only in the short term. This neither eradicated the causes of conflict, nor was it a great deterrent to future aristocratic conspiracies. And in fact, these conspiracies continued to take place from time to time in the Ottonian period. And one evidence of this is precisely the sinusoidal movement of Pax and Discordia explained earlier. In short, without Weberian rationality and without refined administrative tools, the Ottonian kings had only limited capabilities in terms of political planning. They sometimes made some plans and were even able to realize them. We have some examples, but this was not their main attitude. For sure, contingency was not only understood by certain educated and refined clerics in their theological or existential considerations. Contingency points to the structural limits of Ottonian government. To conclude, I would like to highlight 3 points. First, eschatology, apocalypticism, or millennialism do not provide the same knowledge. In Ottonian sources, we can find clues of eschatological awareness, but not clues of apocalyptical anxiety or millenarian utopia. With reference to the question, how coping with the future in the Ottonian period, I would like to point out that eschatology provided a useful knowledge to cope with the individual future after death. Therefore, future as eternity. Second, in order to cope with the near future, the future before the death, we don't have evidence of any strategy of prognostication linked to mantic practices, astronomical calculations, and horoscopes in the Ottonian sources. Rather, coping with the future relied on the knowledge of past and present events. This knowledge showed all earthly events as contingency. And for sure, this contingency would have affected future events as well. Nobody could predict whether tomorrow would have brought exaltatio or humiliatio, pax or discordia, golden age or dark days. Only the Christian sense of transcendence assured that contingency was not mere casuality or randomness, but an instrument of divine pedagogy. Therefore, while current social and political sciences suggest to consider contemporary societies of contingency in opposition to archaic societies of transcendence, we see that in Ottonian sources, contingency and transcendence can be complementary rather than excluding each other. Third and last point, in the more tangible field of politics, the Ottonian way of ruling was not shaped by a rationalization in the Weberian sense. The Ottonian kings had their own political rationality, of course, but it did not consist in optimizing the exercise of power by a systematic approach to planning royal action. Consequently, the Ottonian kings accepted contingency rather than taming and dominating it. Therefore, their main target was to cope successfully with political contingency only in a short-term perspective. Thank you for your kind attention.